Well, good morning, everyone. It's great to be together with God's people, with our church family in particular, and to get to study God's Word together already this morning. Had a great class. It's amazing. I just keep being amazed more and more as we study through the Torah, the Pentateuch, even some of the longest and most granular books of the Bible, how much we can see Jesus. And Al did a great job pointing us to Him this morning. And so grateful for our study, grateful for our worship, and grateful for our fellowship in Christ as a church family here. If you would open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 4, this morning that's where our lesson will be taken from. In the quarter that just ended a couple weeks ago, our Sunday morning class was focused on the Gospel of Matthew. And in mentioning that, first of all, I want to thank Keith for leading us through that study. I got to say, I benefited a lot from studying that Gospel. But secondly, though, one of my favorite things about that study was that I gained a new appreciation for how much Matthew talks about the kingdom of heaven. And that was the cover of the workbook, was the gospel of the kingdom. But how much Matthew talks about the kingdom really stood out to me. And one thing I noticed even more so throughout the entire book is that when the kingdom is spoken of, or when the nature of the kingdom of heaven is explained, one of the most consistent and pervasive concepts throughout the book is that the kingdom of heaven is an upside-down kingdom from what may be expected of a typical kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is totally different from all other kingdoms. And maybe the reason I got so interested in that concept, and maybe even a little fixated on it, is that anytime we see a consistent theme or a recurring motif throughout a book of the Bible, I just find it so helpful in understanding that book better and in understanding the bigger picture that's being communicated by the writer and ultimately by the Holy Spirit, to keep that theme in mind and try to trace that through the entire book. Kind of helps you get a better handle on the book. But in any case, I kind of kept thinking about that concept that we find in the book of Matthew. Even after the class ended, I couldn't let it go. I kept ruminating on this idea that the kingdom of heaven is upside down, or in other words, that it is surprising, or it's unexpected in its nature compared to all other kingdoms that the first century Jews were familiar with, and even the kingdoms and governments that we're familiar with today in our day and time. And maybe you noticed it creeping into some of my sermons for the past few weeks, mentioning or referring to the upside-down nature of the kingdom. So today I figured I would give up the creep and open the floodgates, or in normal human terms, I figured I would preach on it. So anyway, that's what we're going to talk about today. And so as I was reading through the Gospel of Matthew, trying to figure out which section of the text to emphasize to illustrate this idea of the upside-down kingdom, I was first of all reminded why I kept thinking about this nature of the upside-down kingdom as we studied the book, because it's all over the book. Throughout the entirety of Matthew's gospel, it's just consistently through there. But secondly, in trying to narrow it down to text to preach from, because preaching from a whole book would probably be a longer sermon than even I could handle, I kept coming back to one of the most famous, impactful texts in the book, which is the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, and a few verses that preceded as well. But speaking of those verses, it was hard to ignore the couple of verses leading up to that as well, because before Matthew even records what Jesus taught about the nature of the kingdom, he records how Jesus showed the nature of the kingdom by his actions and by his priorities. And so that's where I want to begin this morning as we consider together the upside-down nature of the kingdom of heaven. And so as we begin, let's read Matthew chapter 4. We'll begin in verse 23 there in Matthew 4. Matthew 4:23 says, "And he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, epileptics, and paralytics, and he healed them." So the first thing we see, even just before the Sermon on the Mount begins, is that the people this kingdom focuses on are upside down. Jesus demonstrates this for us. Verse 23 tells us that Jesus went throughout all Galilee proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. So from the very beginning, this was his focus, to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom. Let's start there. I think it's no accident that the book of Matthew focuses on the kingdom and its nature, because this is what Jesus was focused on even from the very earliest moments of his ministry. This is some of the very earliest records we have in this gospel of what Jesus did in those 3 years of his ministry. It's even more unsurprising, Matthew's focus on this, when we consider that it's exactly what John the Baptist proclaimed in his ministry as well. A chapter back in Matthew chapter 3, verse 1, "In those days, John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" And then Jesus indeed proclaims the same type of message as evidenced by chapter 4 and verse 23. You know what I find especially telling in that verse in Matthew 4, 23? There's not even a sentence break between this idea of Jesus proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and him healing every disease and affliction among the people. And what this shows us is that the people whom this kingdom and its king are focused on are not the kind of people you would expect a kingdom to be focused on. Most kingdoms of their day, at least, and even of our day, as we look around the world, are designed to uplift those who are already powerful and wealthy and influential and can help the kingdom maintain its influence or its power. But the kingdom Jesus is heralding here is clearly very, very different. Instead of associating himself with the powerful Roman rulers, you might think of a king's coming in onto the scene, he might go for them and try to make friends with them. Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't even associate himself with the Pharisees or the Sadducees, who we know had great influence over the Jewish people at this time. They looked to them as an authority. But Jesus didn't go to either of those people primarily. Jesus' focus, as we see here in Matthew 4, was on healing people. And it begs the question, what kind of people need healing? What kind of people were these? It's people who are sick, people who are hurt, people who are broken, people who are messy, people who are gross, desperate, people who are out of options. And these are the kind of people Jesus is focused on. Verse 24 tells us that his fame spread throughout all of Syria, and what was the result of that? People came to bow down, people came to pay him taxes or try to give him money and get in good with him? No. People brought him, quote, all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, epileptics, and paralytics, and he healed them. And this shows us the nature of Jesus' fame, even his popularity. This king was famous. He was known for serving the neediest of society. He was known for serving the downcast, the desperate. These were the people this king was focused on. He was famous for helping the people that most would simply ignore. But this leads us right into the Sermon on the Mount. Surely it can't be accidental that Matthew juxtaposes this emphasis of Jesus' focus on the sick, on the afflicted and troubled, with a record of a powerful sermon of his that opens with a description of what this very kingdom values. And so what we learn from this is that not only are the people this kingdom is focused on not the kind of people you would expect, but even the values of this kingdom seem quite upside down. Let's read together Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. Matthew 5 and verse 1 says, "Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And so as we see, as we go through this text, that the values of this kingdom are also upside down. These Beatitudes, as we call them, are a little more than meets the eye. We're kind of used to reading these. If we've studied Matthew before, we're kind of used to these Beatitudes. We know what they say, and we're kind of accustomed to them. But to the original readers, they would have been pretty shocking and pretty confusing even. And I think if we really consider them, and if we really listen to what Jesus is saying, it might shock and confuse us a little bit more than we think. But even considering Jesus' original audience, in the day and time in which he presented these statements, they would have flown in the face of the typical wisdom that these Jews and these people he's listening to him would have been accustomed to. I mean, even today, though, our familiarity with the Beatitudes, even as a society, people kind of know this text decently well. It's reasonably high familiarity. But how many self-help books could be sold using the Beatitudes as the values and the guidelines on which to base the good life? Telling people you ought to be mourning, you ought to give up your rights in order to show mercy to somebody else, or you ought to give up your happiness in order to make peace, or you ought to be persecuted, then you'll be happy. How popular is that going to be? These aren't the kind of suggestions that even we in our day and time would readily accept. Truly, these statements are pretty shocking. But Jesus' ultimate goal isn't just to come up with something offensive enough that people are going to be like, whoa, what's he saying, and pay attention to him. That's not the point. No, what Jesus is actually doing is giving us a picture of what the kingdom of heaven values in its citizens. These Beatitudes, as we call them, they're not isolated proverbs that are meant to apply to specific groups of people. Growing up, I definitely used to read them that way, thinking that they were just meant to comfort different kinds of people who maybe weren't much in this world. But don't worry, you'll have something special in heaven, and that'll be good. But that's not the truth. The truth is that together they form a complete picture, a thorough description of those who would seek to be part of this kingdom about which Jesus is talking. And Jesus isn't saying by these Beatitudes that, you know, if you happen to be a person who's meek, then guess what? You inherit the earth. Congratulations, we're super happy for you. Or, hey, if you're poor in spirit, then your reward is the kingdom of heaven. Yay, isn't that neat? I don't think that's the point at all here in the context of what Jesus is saying about the kingdom. Again, these aren't isolated statements that are designed to sound nice or little sayings that would look good if we crocheted them on a pillow, nor are they intended to describe a bunch of different types of individuals as they currently are in this world. Jesus is saying, if you would be a citizen of my kingdom, of the kingdom of heaven, all of this is what you must look like. This is what I value in my kingdom. And so we see that those who are great in the kingdom of heaven exhibit not the earthly values of power or money or prestige or anything like that. On the contrary, the values that count in the kingdom of heaven are recognition of spiritual destitution in verse 3, the poor in spirit. Acceptance of times of sadness, like we see in verse 4. Meekness and humility in verse 5. A determination to be righteous that rivals someone who is desperate for food itself in verse 6. A willingness to let go of what is fair, instead to show mercy in verse 7. And then being pure in verse 8. The making of peace by self-denial in verse 9. And even the suffering of persecution in verses 10 through 11. These are what the kingdom of heaven values. They say, this is a good citizen of the kingdom of heaven. And what kind of earthly kingdom could you possibly hope to initiate and sustain where these are the pillars of what it means to be a citizen of that kingdom? Or maybe an even better question is, what kind of kingdom could you possibly hope to have where these are the core values and characteristics of the king himself? Who wants a king like that? And so we see that this is totally upside down from what anyone would have expected. And in Jesus' day, he was faced with a Jewish religious world where expertise and compliance in technicalities of law and code were considered to be what made a person most pleasing to God. So as a result of that environment, the description Jesus gives of the true kingdom citizen, again, would be surprising to say the least. But even in our day, our constitution and our form of government is kinder to its citizens than perhaps any other earthly government in history. Yet it doesn't look anything quite like this. What I want us to see here is that whether we lived in the first century or today, what Jesus is teaching is radical. It's different. The things valued in the kingdom of heaven are unexpected. They're shocking. Compared to anything else this world has ever seen or heard, they truly are upside down from this world. But the people focused on and the values held by this king and his kingdom are not the only things that seem upside down. Because you see, even the relationships of this kingdom are upside down. Drop down to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 38. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust." Most kingdoms are built with a judicial system, on the idea of those who do evil receiving a punishment that fits the crime. We're used to that. In fact, the punishment fits the crime is just generally an accepted maxim that's often applied across the board to life in general, whether you're talking about a government or a parent disciplining their child or policies at a company or anything like that. Even in the Old Testament, the law of the tooth, often referred to by its fancier name of lex talionis, said basically the same thing. The punishment fits the crime. But yet, in explaining the way people who are part of his kingdom respond to evil, Jesus says the punishment ought not fit the crime. He calls those who would be citizens of heaven's kingdom to show only mercy to those who wronged them or did evil against them. Again, maybe our familiarity with this verse kind of masks the possibility and works against us in masking the really shocking nature of this teaching that Jesus gives. I mean, just consider the very practical, the very vivid applications he gives as examples of this principle. If someone slaps you on one cheek, say, here, slap me on the other as well. If someone sues you and wants some of your property and takes you to court, give him not only what he asked for, but give him some extra as well. That's crazy. I think we miss that sometimes. If someone tries to force you to do something for him, not only are you to do it, but to go above and beyond what he asked for. I mean, how many of you, if Mike asks you to run 10 miles, are going to say, yeah, let's go 20? I mean, maybe, I don't know anybody who would, but if we're honest with ourselves, it seems upside down. It really does. But this is how Jesus describes his kingdom. And then going on into the next section of the test, Jesus doesn't let up with this drastic, seemingly upside-down type of teaching. He proceeds to teach that those who are a part of the kingdom will not only love their neighbor when their neighbor is a friend of theirs, someone they like being with, rather, he calls them to not just love their friends, not even just people they don't like, but even go so far as to love people who had done evil against them, to love their enemies. Just like in every other case we've seen, Jesus is taking something that had been normalized by society. Hating someone who hates you seems fine. But Jesus takes that and he turns it upside down. He says those who seek to be part of the kingdom of heaven will have very different looking relationships with everyone in their lives, across the board, even the people who hate them or have done evil to them. Not only will their relationships with family and friends now come second to their relationship with the king, which Jesus addresses elsewhere in his teaching, but their kingdom citizenship is going to cause their relationships with even their enemies to look totally different. Jesus is calling them to go beyond what is natural, to turn their instincts and their cultural norms, whatever they had previously coming into the kingdom, on their heads, to go against those things in order to be true citizens of his kingdom. And what I'd submit to you is that the same is true for us today. Everything Jesus has called kingdom citizens to here in Matthew chapters 4 and 5 is radical. It's shocking. It's uncomfortable. And quite frankly, it seems kind of crazy. It's okay to say that. It seems crazy. It should, if we're actually reading it as it is. From showing that his kingdom is concerned primarily with people who are sick, people who are destitute, dirty, messy, and impoverished, to teaching that the things valued in his kingdom are willingness to suffer persecution, self-denial in order to make peace, willingness to suffer through sadness, and the like, to even calling would-be kingdom citizens to love the people who hate them. Jesus is defying conventional wisdom, he's defying cultural norms, and just about every sort of expectation that they could have of a king, or that we could as well. And so we see this kingdom he's proclaiming is upside down. It's completely upside down. Or is it? Or is it? See, when we say that the kingdom is upside down, I think it begs the question, upside down from what? Because in order to have an upside down, you've got to have a right side up. What do we consider to be right side up? And so as we move on to trying to apply these teachings of Jesus, I would suggest to you that the kingdom of heaven is only upside down if we allow our society and culture to define what is right side up. Certainly the world and society around us have strong opinions on what is right side up. They have those opinions, and not only do they have them, they are eager to tell us what they are and what we should think as well. But aren't we as Christians called to take a different view than accepting society's standard? For one, Jesus is calling us to reject the world's definitions of what is right side up. He's calling us to choose a different standard, his standard, the kingdom standard. But even more importantly, he isn't just calling us to another of many arbitrary standards that are out there. His standard is based on much more than cultural opinion or human history. His standard is even based on more than just himself, and that would be quite the basis. What we have to realize is that the kingdom of heaven's idea of what is right is the standard because it is based on the authority of God the Father, the King of the universe. Anything that our society, our earthly kingdoms, or anyone else proposes as the norm, anything anybody defines as what is typical and acceptable, is not a legitimate standard by which we can determine what's right side up. And the reason their standards, their ideas of what is normal or acceptable, are invalid stem from the fact that the basis by which they defined their standard is illegitimate. It is invalid compared to the basis by which heaven's kingdom defines the standard, which is God the Father himself. And ultimately what this means is that it is not the kingdom of heaven that's really upside down. It's not these teachings of Jesus that seem so crazy and so radical that are really upside down. It's the world and its twisted idea of what is normal and right that's upside down, because they've put the king of the universe, who is over everything, at the bottom of their world, and they've elevated their own personal ideas to the top. The kingdom of heaven is undoubtedly what is right side up. Acknowledging that God sits on the ultimate throne over this universe and allowing that truth to then define the rest of our reality, that's right side up thinking. So the challenge for us this morning is to orient our standards, for each and every one of us, to order our way of life and our way of thinking in a way that is upside down from the world, but is right side up in reality. We're called not only to choose a different standard than the world for what is right, what is good, what is true, but to choose the standard for what is right, for what is good, and what is true. If we're truly seeking to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven, we must choose the standard that is upside down from the world, but is ultimately right side up because it is based in the universal kingship of God himself. If we start by acknowledging God, by acknowledging that he's above all else on his throne above the universe, we're going to look different from the world. We're going to look to them as if we are upside down, as if we're messed up. But in reality, we will be seeing things as they really are, because we're looking beyond these men's imperfect ideas of what's right, what's good, and what's true. And we're looking to the ultimate authority of God himself to define those things for us. But here's the kicker, and here's where I may have to quit preaching and go to meddling for myself as well. I think in principle, we know this is what is asked of us if we would be kingdom citizens. But the tough question we have to ask ourselves is this actually the way I think? Is this actually the way I think? Because as much as we like to think that we really are so different from the world, like God calls us to be, I worry that so many of us, myself included, we tend to water down our Christian worldview so that it's really not so upside down, just maybe a little bit sideways. Even if we call ourselves Christians, have we adopted the world's view of what is right, or maybe even just what is valued or what is normal? Are society's values our values? Do we look at Christianity as if it's kind of the upside down part of our lives, but overall we're just a little slanted, we can fit in? Or do we look at the world as if it is completely upside down and consider ourselves to be entirely part of the right side up kingdom that actually has it right? That's tough, because then you get labeled as a cult or crazy or upside down. It almost sounds like what Jesus got accused of. And I'm not saying we ought to be arrogant. Quite the opposite, in fact. As we just read, the Beatitudes record how Jesus taught that those who are part of the kingdom of heaven are meek and lowly. But what Jesus is calling us all to do is to cut our ties with the way our society and our culture thinks about everything, and to reorient our way of thinking entirely around the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom's people, the kingdom's values, and the kingdom's relationships. It's like Al was talking about. That was perfect with the tabernacle at the center of Israel's setup in their encampment. It's at the middle. Everything else is oriented around God's presence. And then everything else in our lives falls into place after that. And here's another thought that was tough for me, but I think we need to think about. In a country that has historically espoused Christianity as its most common religion, even as much of a blessing as that is, and I'm thankful for it, but it's also incredibly easy to start to conflate the way Christians ought to think with the way that Americans think. When we say that we need to leave behind the way society thinks, we're not just talking about some faraway, godless, communist society. We are talking about any society or culture that is not the kingdom of heaven itself. It is so easy to get lost in thinking like Americans. I need to defend my rights as an American, or I'll worry about me and you worry about you and yours, and wanting to make sure criminals get what they deserve, and the punishment's got to fit the crime, and other American ways of thinking, or that I'm self-sufficient and I don't need anybody else. We forget that these ideas can be incompatible with a kingdom way of thinking. The reason I list all those is that guilty is charged, 100%, of thinking all those things. But you know what? God calls us to sacrifice even our most cherished American values when they do not line up with the values of the kingdom. Our basis for our way of thinking cannot be American ideas, on top of which we overlay the ideas of God's kingdom, where they fit in. Kingdom values must come first. They must come first always. Even in a country like the U.S., we have to be willing to turn our way of thinking upside down from those around us in order to be right side up in God's eyes. That's what matters. If we're truly to be kingdom citizens, we got to cut ourselves loose from thinking like the world does and view things through a worldview that begins and ends with God as the ultimate king. And that's what we all need to see ultimately. But not only does this affect the way that we think or the way we look at the world and our basis for reality and our worldview, but being a citizen of the kingdom of heaven is very practical because it means turning our own lives upside down from the rest of the world and right side up in the eyes of God. Jesus came and he told us and he showed us not only what right side up thinking looks like, but what right side up living looks like. If we want to be kingdom citizens, not only do we need to think upside down from the world, but each and every one of us needs to live in a way that is upside down from the world. We're not just trying to be countercultural for the sake of being countercultural and going against the grain. The reason we ought to be countercultural and upside down from the world is because placing God on his rightful throne over our lives will make us upside down from the world. And in being upside down from the world in that way, acknowledging God as king and letting him direct our lives, our values, and our relationships, we will be right side up. Looking at things upside down from the world causes a change, first of all, in the way we see people and the people we focus on, just as Jesus showed us in Matthew chapter 4. Just like Jesus focused on different people than the world focuses on, we must do the same. If we're following Jesus, we're called to care for the poor, the homeless, the helpless, the gross, the messy, the downtrodden, or the people who are unpopular and nobody wants to talk about or look at or acknowledge. Ultimately, a kingdom mindset flips the way that we see people right side up. We no longer evaluate people based on what they can do for us or how good of an ally they'll be for us in our attempts to be successful or powerful or wealthy or how much we'll enjoy their company even. But if we're kingdom citizens, we got to look at people with a view toward how deeply we can show God's love to them, like Jesus did. But not only does this change the way we view other people, it changes the way we view ourselves. Kingdom doesn't value those who think much of themselves, who are proud or who seek power and wealth. As kingdom citizens, we have to see our spiritual destitution. We have to make ourselves meek and humble and poor in spirit, yet consider ourselves blessed immensely by Jesus. Every single beatitude, every single description of kingdom citizens there in Matthew 5 begins with that word, blessed. That's what we are. We're blessed. Not because we amount to something amazing in and of ourselves, and we have to realize that, but because in coming to Jesus spiritually in need, poor in spirit, destitute, we are blessed by him beyond compare. It is in him that we find our value and our worth. And so we see others and we see ourselves differently when we are citizens of the kingdom and we act differently. We focus on different people. Our lives look different, the way we act ourselves and the way we act toward others. But not only does kingdom citizenship change the way we view others and ourselves and act towards them, but it changes our values and the way we live those out as well. As part of the kingdom of heaven, a high view of self-reliance is replaced by valuing humility and recognition of a spiritually needy condition. As part of God's kingdom, prizing comfort and affluence instead gives way to a willingness to suffer and be persecuted, put through hardships for Jesus' sake. And all our values that are upside down in God's eyes are flipped right side up so that they now fit with the way he sees the world. And as a result, the way we live is changed. And as our values lead to this change in our lives, people are going to notice this change in values. And Jesus anticipates this, as a matter of fact, when he says in verse 13 of Matthew 5:13, you are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. In verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Jesus says people ought to notice us, that we're upside down from them. When we change our values and our lives look different, but when they do, the goal is not for them to see us and build us up. The goal is that they will see God the Father, our King, who is at the top of our lives. That's who they ought to see. God, King of our lives, just as he is King above the universe, which is what makes our lives right side up. And finally, our relationships are going to be flipped on their heads when we're kingdom citizens. Instead of seeking what's good for us and trying to get as much personal happiness out of our relationships as we can and looking to what's in it for me and what can you do for me, we're called to sacrifice, to love even our enemies. When people hurt us, not to retaliate, but to show mercy instead. Show them kindness. Show them God's love. This kingdom living sounds crazy in the context of the world and even the country that we live in. And for sure, it's upside down compared to what surrounds us now as we live on this earth. But as kingdom citizens, we're told we're strangers and pilgrims, sojourners on the earth anyway. We seek a better country, that is a heavenly one, in which righteousness dwells and in which every knee has bowed and every tongue confessed that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So, a few questions for us all as we close here. Have we confessed Jesus as Lord and obeyed him? But more than that, are our knees bowed to King Jesus each and every day? Are our actions upside down from the world, but not just upside down from the world, in step with the kingdom of heaven? If these things are true, we're already citizens of the right side up kingdom of heaven. Like we were talking about last week, with writing our story with the end in mind, if we're already citizens of the kingdom of heaven and these things are true, the promised reality of that better country is truly going to be ours one day. But if these things aren't true, we better give careful attention to making sure that our way of life, our way of thinking, but especially our way of life, fit none other than the King himself's description of the kingdom of heaven. Kingdom that Hebrews says cannot be shaken. Looking forward to talking about that some this quarter as well. I hope these things have been helpful to you. Living an upside down life or a right side up life in an upside down world is difficult. That's why we have each other. That's why we have the family of Christ. So we can help each other as we try to live in a way that's different from the world, but that's right side up in God's eyes. So God bless us all as we try to do that. If we can help you with a spiritual need this morning, we'd love to do that. You can make that known. Come forward as we stand, as we sing the invitation song.